Gaza today, 17 in Gaza City. Israeli officials say at least 12 rockets have been fired by Palestinian militants into southern Israel. The United States President-elect Barack Obama has said that once he comes into office, he'll immediately become involved in trying to break the deadlock in the Middle East. In a television interview, Mr. Obama said he was very disturbed by the Israeli offensive in Gaza. He said he would be committed to finding a resolution to the conflict from the moment he took office in 9 days' time.
The reason it's so important for the United States to be engaged and involved immediately, not waiting till the end of their term, is because working through the politics of this requires a third party that everybody has confidence, wants to see a fair and just outcome.
The Ministry of Defence has said within the past hour that a Royal Marine has been killed by an explosion in Helmand province in southern Afghanistan. The Marine was from UK Landing Force Command Support Group, operating as part of 4-5 Commando Royal Marines. His next of kin have been informed. The army has said the case of Prince Harry's use of racist language will be dealt with in line with normal procedures. Home video footage shows him referring to an Asian member of his platoon as a Paki. He's apologised. An army statement said all substantive allegations of inappropriate behaviour were investigated. The Conservative leader David Cameron has insisted that only a change of government can restore confidence in the economy. Gordon Brown and his ministers are preparing to announce details tomorrow of plans to encourage long-term unemployed people into work. BBC News.
Well, in 40 minutes, this week's edition of Profile will discover how an ambitious South African teenager became, in under a decade, a key figure in England's sporting life, Kevin Peterson. This is BBC Radio 4. From 1992 to 2004, when he became a United States Senator, Barack Obama held down a distinguished post as a part-time lecturer in constitutional law at the University of Chicago. In this programme now, the philosophy professor Kwame Anthony Appiah investigates the shaping of Obama's ideas and the way his mind works. Obama, Professor President.
We measure progress by how many people can find a job that pays the mortgage. Whether you can put a little extra money away at the end of each month so you can someday watch your child receive her college diploma. I think about my mom, who raised my sister and me on her own while she worked and earned her degree, who once turned to food stamps but was still able to send us to the best schools in the country with the help of student loans and scholarships.
No one doubts Barack Obama's commitment to education. But someone asked recently at a dinner party I was at, how smart is Obama really? Super brainy was the consensus, and they thought too that he was a serious intellectual. This was amongst a group of friends, a handful of academics and assorted others, Americans, all of us, black and white. Yes, I know I don't sound so American, but in this nation of immigrants, Americans can sound pretty much like anyone. There may be those who doubt Obama's claim to standing as an intellectual. No one doubts his impressive oratorical skills.
And it is that promise that 45 years ago today brought Americans from every corner of this land to stand together on a mall in Washington before Lincoln's memorial and hear a young preacher from Georgia speak of his dream.
I think there is something of the Baptist preacher and something of Dr. Martin Luther King in his oratory.
Obama's mentor, Abner Mikva. Like him, he combined academic law with politics.
And I think Barack Obama understands that oratory is both style and substance. Now,
but he also probably knows more about Lincoln's oratory than many, certainly than any president since Lincoln.
Contrary to my appearance, I was not around when Abraham Lincoln was president. But I don't think he was a great speaker, at least the books I've read, and I've read a lot of them, perhaps not as many as Barack, but I've read a lot, do not indicate that Lincoln had particularly a very good voice or that he knew how to resonate. He was very thoughtful about what he said. And I think that there is a lot of that in Barack Obama's speeches, that he has gone back to look at the substance of what Lincoln and some of our other great presidents have said. But the style is much more that of the Baptist church.
What the people heard instead people of every creed and color from every walk of life is that in America, together, our dreams can be one.
And my dinner companions mostly thought, this speech combines style with substance masterfully. And they admired his accomplished autobiography, Dreams from My Father, that reveals so much about his influences. But none of the crucial encounters Obama describes in his autobiography are with teachers. It's slightly surprising how he skirts over his educational history. He hardly mentions lessons at Punahou, the elite school in Hawaii, where he had a mini-afro hairstyle and was known as Barry. And he says he chose to go to Occidental, a liberal arts college in Los Angeles, because of a girl. Then he crossed the country to Columbia in New York and went a little later to Harvard for a law degree. But there aren't many details about his studies. And when he gets the letter of acceptance into Harvard, he seems oddly unexcited. In fact, during his presidential campaign, Obama played down his association with prestigious elite universities. I tracked down his friend Kenneth Mack, who's now a professor at Harvard and one of Obama's few black student contemporaries. And he talked to me about Obama's ambivalence about going to that Ivy League university. Professor Mack remembers Barack giving the keynote speech at a black students' conference.
You heard quite well-known people speak, but Barack gave perhaps the most memorable speech that we've heard at that event. The punchline of the speech was, "Don't let Harvard change you." And he sort of wove that idea into this incredibly compelling speech that was sort of all about the tensions between being at an elite institution at Harvard and also being from communities for whom Harvard was a very distant place that didn't seem to have much impact on their lives. I mean, the speech was really about the morality of being at Harvard when it's very different from the communities from which you come.
You see, his warning to the black students not to get sucked into the establishment was quite understandable, given that Barack had taken time off following his Columbia undergraduate degree to do community work. He didn't go into the Peace Corps or follow one of the other well-trodden routes young American college graduates often take. Instead, in 1985, he joined a small organization in Chicago to work in African-American neighborhoods on the tough South Side. It was an experience that schooled him perhaps more than any at a university. He got to grips with the dysfunctions of race, income, and class, which led to his deep commitment to this area of social policy.
When he first arrived in Chicago, he was like a baby.
Michael Kruglig, community organizer from Chicago.
The basic concepts and disciplines of community organizing that he encountered were like mother's milk to him. And he drank very deeply of that mother's milk, and it nurtured him politically and even intellectually.
This community work trained local people to help themselves by establishing the issues that united them. Once united, they could confront city officials. Kruglik says Obama was a very successful trainer.
Barack was a very compassionate and empathetic person as soon as he got here. He believed that every human being deserves a decent shot at a decent life. And he became a tremendous trainer. And there's a kind of common picture of him, almost always inappropriately labeled as Obama teaching a class at the University of Chicago Law School. It's actually Obama doing a leadership training session on power analysis.
And who was he training?
He was training grassroots community leaders. Not that that was what he was seeking. It's just the closest thing he could come to a civil rights organization.
Apparently, Obama at that time had a favorite quote from Martin Luther King. "Love without power is mere sentimentality. Love plus power equals justice."
He really would have preferred to be a civil rights organizer, like Dr. King. But by the time Barack graduated from Columbia, the civil rights movement no longer was really doing that type of work.
Studying King and through King studying the ideas of Gandhi, he also got very rich ideas of human cooperation, of grassroots mobilization, the importance of getting people empowered from the grassroots level up to take charge of their own political lives and their own economic lives. So I think that also feeds very much into the way he would approach any current problem.
That was Martha Nussbaum, University of Chicago professor of law and philosophy. I don't want to get dramatic about it, but many people I talked to suggested Obama was struggling to combine his intellectual passions with his moral crusade in the service of the disadvantaged. Obama thought he could resolve that dilemma in postgraduate law, as Lawrence Tribe, professor at Harvard, explains.
When we talked about his reasons for coming to law school and for learning about the operations of the law, they had very much to do with empowering the worst off. The rule of law is, I think, in his mind, opposed to the law of the powerful.
Now, I happen to share part of Barack Obama's story. I'm half African, my dad was Ghanaian, and my mother was white. English, actually, which is why I talk like this. I didn't grow up in America, and I was educated in British universities. Like me, Obama's cosmopolitan background gives him a distinctive curiosity about the world, which will be a refreshing change for an American president. University of Chicago professor Martha Nussbaum studies international philosophical theory.
As a child of this very complicated mixed background with roots in Africa, but then the multicultural Hawaii that he grew up in, and all the different strands, the mother from Kansas, he's thought a lot about culture and identity, but also thought a lot about the world. And he has a passionate interest in Africa, of course, and that showed up when he went to Africa. He was just so well informed. And we did talk some about the Middle East, and I think he's deeply thoughtful about that. And he's ferociously independent.
Now, I spent almost all my adult life teaching philosophy in American universities. So here's another thing that I bet we share. I bet he, like me, has experienced the kind of intellectual condescension that's par for the course if you're a black thinker in a largely white university world. Yet, no one I talked to suggested he ever seemed remotely ill at ease, and he seems to have put everyone he met, black and white, teacher, colleague and student, at their ease as well. All the same, though he wasn't banging the gong for racial equality, when Barack got to Harvard, there was one course which particularly interested him, a course on race and inequality with respect to the law. And at Harvard, that was being explored through the then new approach called critical race theory. Here's his friend and contemporary, Kenneth Mack.
What critical race theory represented in part was a deep dissatisfaction with the inequalities that remained in American society, a skepticism about the legal tools that we were being taught in law school, the ability of those legal tools in remedying that inequality. And I think Barack was very much affected by that debate, by the pessimism. But at the end of the day, he's not a pessimist. Everything about him screams that he is optimistic about the possibilities of America, the possibilities of the world, the possibilities of improving on certain forms of structural inequality that persist.
If Obama felt any racial tension, it didn't stop him excelling or impressing those who taught him.
His mind was extraordinary, and its character was somewhat apparent to me from the very first meeting.
Harvard's Lawrence Tribe, one of the leading constitutional law experts in America.
I met him for the first time when he was a first-year law student, before he had begun to study constitutional law. He came to my office and expressed interest in some of my ideas, some of my writings, and at the end of that meeting, I was so impressed by his inquisitiveness, his curiosity, how well-read he was, how thoughtful he was, that I asked him then and there to be my research assistant. And we worked together on two very challenging projects. And in each of them, he made a very distinctive imprint, much more than a research assistant would normally do. The first was an article that ended up being called The Curvature of Constitutional Space, and it was subtitled What Lawyers Can Learn from Modern Physics. Now, that's not the kind of subject that one could ordinarily explore with a potential future president, not to say anything negative about our presidents, but I don't remember anyone else impressing me quite as much in the combination of intellect and learning that he had. And among my students was the man who's going to swear Barack Obama in as the 44th president of the United States, John Roberts, the Chief Justice. Very, very smart. But I think Barack Obama is on the whole
at least as impressive, probably more so because of the breadth of qualities that his mind displays. And I suppose it's also a kind of emotional intelligence as well as analytical intelligence.
Another eminent Harvard professor who knew Obama was Robert Putnam, who'd just written Bowling Alone, which is one of those great idea books. It's about how people in America are distancing themselves from their communities. He asked the young Barack Obama to participate at a high-level think tank on connecting communities.
Obama's role, the role he chose for himself in a sense, was to be pretty quiet for the first day or so of the weekend. And then toward the middle of the weekend, he would speak and say, well, now I hear Joe saying such and such, and I hear Marie saying this other thing, and Joe and Marie think they're really fighting with each other. But actually, I think, listening to you, that both Joe and Marie agree that, and then he'd articulate some integrative version of the argument, which did find some common agreement between the two of them. Now, it's important that I emphasize that these were very strong-minded, very experienced people. They did not just fall off the turnip truck.
Obama took the skills he'd learned from listening to people's troubles in his community work to another level.
And it was a skill of a rare order that he was able to find this common ground between people who were smart, articulate, experienced advocates for particular points of view. Actually, when you see it, when you saw that skill in practice, it was breathtaking.
His talent for reconciliation had already been on display when he was chosen to be president of the Harvard Law Review in 1990. It made national headlines because he was the first African-American holder of that title. The Review is probably the leading scholarly journal in American law and publishes articles from the most prominent thinkers. So having this position was a powerful academic credential. It was also Obama's first electoral victory, won in part by convincing the conservative minority of law students that he would treat them fairly. Professor David Wilkins.
At the time, Harvard Law School was a deeply divided institution. In fact, a friend of mine once dubbed it the Beirut of legal education. And that was pretty accurate. In his tenure as president of the Law Review, he wanted to get the institution beyond the kind of paralysis that had fairly overtaken it in this kind of intensely political era in which there was such mistrust and such suspicion among members of the group that it was really getting in the way of its functioning. And I think if you look at his tenure there and you look at the way in which people who were on the magazine at the time speak of it, he was very successful in accomplishing that goal. And yet people understood that he had views not just about the institution, but about the substantive issues at stake.
When he leaves Harvard, the editor gets to pick from lucrative job offers. But while no one expected Barack to pursue a materialistic career, many were still surprised that he went back to Chicago to pick up where he'd left off training community action groups. Amidst the day-to-day struggles of getting asbestos removed from housing estates and helping teenage mothers, Obama found time to write short stories, which he showed to his old colleague, Michael Kruglick.
He was a solitary, almost ascetic type of an individual. You know, he had a small apartment.
So he had a little bit of furniture and a bunch of books?
Yeah, a bunch of books and a cat.
He had a cat?
Yeah. In that sense, although it's something of a pejorative term, and one which I don't know, I've certainly never heard him apply to himself. But in that sense, he was a sort of an intellectual. Now, when I read the stories, one could see the bleakness of the South Side Chicago landscape, particularly in these communities on the far South Side that were really isolated and really poor, and took place during the winter. And sometimes, you know, a gray Chicago day with a lot of, you know, old, dirty snow on the ground and some neon lights sort of flickering through the dimness. I was deeply touched by them. That's when I realized that they weren't made up or they weren't taken from some short story collection, because I recognized the people. Those were people that I knew. But then I realized that in order for him to capture these lives in such an evocative way, he really had to feel what they were feeling.
Did you talk to him about how he learned to write like that?
No. I think he was learning as he went along.
These stories sound like a preparation for the book deal he'd secured after his famous triumph at Harvard. And while he was writing what turned out to be Dreams from My Father, he was offered a place at the University of Chicago. Douglas Baird, who teaches at the law school and was dean at the time, recruited him.
I hired Barack Obama because I heard that he was the president of the Harvard Law Review, which has been the starting point for many promising careers in legal education, and that he had done a splendid job editing a piece by a very conservative colleague of mine. And I thought that it would be basically costless for us to find out if he had an interest in the Legal Academy. And it turned out he didn't have an interest in the Legal Academy, but because he was going to write a book, originally it was a book about voting rights, later became Dreams of My Father, we were able to persuade him to come here, give him an office, and give him an opportunity to write this book, and over time persuade him to do some teaching for us.
I'm sitting in the office of one of the professors here at the University of Chicago Law School, looking out over a beautiful view of the Chicago Midway, which was created for the Chicago World's Fair in the late 19th century. Lovely garden, really, with trees, and on the other side of it, a rather imposing-looking building with towers, which is part of the University of Chicago. And the building I'm in is a beautiful piece of, a great piece of modern architecture by Iris Aaronen, which allows the faculty here these tremendous views through these wonderful windows, but also connects them with one another through the library, which is in the hall behind me, which means that as they come and go about their work, they interact with each other, they bump into their students, and it creates a very intense intellectual atmosphere.
What makes Chicago unique as an intellectual environment relative to virtually any other law school is its sort of adamant commitment to non-specialization on the part of its regular faculty members.
That's Richard Epstein, one of the most distinguished Chicago University law professors who taught with Obama.
We're a small enough institution, and when Obama was there, we're even smaller still, so that in a pinch, anyone would have to teach pretty much anything in order to make sure that the curriculum was covered. And it's really a very exhilarating place to be because you can speak to pretty much anybody about any topic at any time, and we always learn to shoot from the hip. It's a Chicago virtue, and are willing at lunches and at workshops to ask questions out of field, where we think we have some intelligence about the subject, but no particular knowledge. And in fact, those kinds of risky questions are often uninformative, but when they're right, they can transform the work of somebody within a field. So this cross-penetration of fields has led, I think, to real intellectual excellence.
Richard Epstein's well known as a conservative libertarian. Ideologically, he's part of a school of thought pioneered here in the 60s. It's the Chicago School of Law and Economics, which built on the work of economists at Chicago, like Milton Friedman, the founder of monetarism, who advocated market freedom and less government intervention in society. Professor Bernard Harcourt.
It's fair to say that the law and economics approach leads to conservative policies and to a more conservative view of the law. It's a view that ultimately looks at the law through the question of efficiency. And as a result, law and economics, and it's in part shaped by the Chicago School of Economics, which itself was the Milton Friedman laissez-faire approach, was always on the right side of the political spectrum. The law school tends to be viewed as more conservative than other elite law schools.
You can't be around a place that is the home of Milton Friedman and the notion there's no such thing as a free lunch without some of that taking hold. And so I think if you compare Obama with other liberal Democrats, he's someone who has a much more hardwired understanding that there is no such thing as a free lunch, that if you do X, that also means you're not doing Y, and that decisions come with costs, decisions come with consequences, and you can't simply have something for everyone. And so if you listen to his rhetoric and the way he talks, whether it's about the automobile crisis or something else, he is much more emphatic in his support of free markets than liberal politicians generally are. He's much more aware of the costs and the downsides of government regulation. So I think at some level, the Obama you see today is someone who, you know, spent 12 years at a place where everyone says there's no free lunch.
That's Douglas Baird. But now, Chicago economics has diverged, and there's a new field of behavioral economics. In the older economics, you tried to explain social phenomena with models that assume that people are basically rational. In behavioral economics, you start from psychological insights into the ways in which we're not. Two professors of this persuasion have been advisors to Obama during his presidential campaign and will have influence in the future government. I'm talking about Cass Sunstein, who co-wrote a best-selling book, the shortened title of which is Nudge, about how governments can learn to influence people's economic choices, and a young economic superstar at the Chicago Business School, Austin Goolsbee, who Obama has made one of his senior economic advisors. These contending schools of thought are well-defined at the university, but Obama isn't someone who aligns himself with any one point of view. Dan Johnson-Weinberger is a former pupil.
I think he has very little patience for the idea that there's an ideology which always brings truth, and rather truth comes from coldly analyzing actual results. He was a cool professor, not a stuffy or tweety or distant professor.
In case you're wondering why he's often referred to as a professor, well, at most other American universities, a regular adjunct teacher would be called professor. But this place has its own traditions. So his official title was lecturer and, eventually, senior lecturer. At Chicago Law School, senior lecturer is a pretty exalted title, which has been held by some major legal scholars. But Obama never did any original research or published any scholarly papers. He was employed to be a practitioner teacher. And anyway, he was far too busy with his life outside the university. Here's Douglas Baird again.
When he decided to become a state senator, he, which is a part-time position in Illinois, he at that time wanted to have a more permanent relationship with the University of Chicago. Interestingly enough, even though this is a place where colleagues interact very closely and exchange ideas, and where that's a large part of what people think of as being a faculty member at the University of Chicago, from the very first, he made it clear to me, I was dean at the time, that his interest in coming here was not to participate in that conversation. Rather, his interest in coming here was to teach, and he was a splendid teacher. And indeed, if you look at what he taught over the course of 12 years, courses in the history of race relations in this country, voting rights, and the law of the American Constitution, he spent these 12 years deeply immersed in the American legal tradition and that part of the American legal tradition that's most closely associated with things he cared most about, things like race relations, things about the role of government, protection of individual liberties.
The former student I spoke to, Dan Johnson-Weinberger, is now a politically committed attorney in Chicago. Dan wanted to be taught by Obama because he brought his outside experience as a state legislator into the classroom.
As a legislator and as an organizer, as someone who had engaged with government as a change agent, he could bring a more helpful set of experiences to bear to the academic discussion about how government really works and how democracy really functions, which I found very refreshing.
There were other reasons, too, why Barack was popular with his students.
A seminar with Barack was unlike most classes at the law school. Most classes at the law school have the, you know, the professor is the sun around which the universe revolves, and he or she is the source of all wisdom. He or she, particularly at the University of Chicago, employs the Socratic method. Students quiver in terror, waiting to be called on at random. Barack was a collaborative discussion with someone who felt more like a peer than an authority figure. He was younger than most professors. He was working three jobs. You know, he was a state senator and a attorney at a law firm and a law lecturer. So as we were struggling, he was struggling. We related more to him. He was certainly of students' culture more. He worked out, played basketball.
I have to say that personally, I ran into him more often at the gym.
Intellectuals who, unlike me, like to torture their bodies are a special breed. Martha Nussbaum, when she's not teaching philosophy and law, runs marathons.
He was running at something like 9.0, and I was running at something like 6.0 or less. But anyway, you know, because he's a very good runner. And I was pleased to note that when it came to upper body weight equipment, he wasn't way up there. He
I could compete a little bit.
But when it comes to other forms of relaxation, Barack's reading matter never seems to have been frivolous. We never found anyone who could remember novels he'd read, except for passing references to Toni Morrison and Harry Potter, even though they all insisted that he read widely. He always appeared to be reading for some higher purpose. Authors like the black abolitionist Frederick Douglass, whom he set as coursework, says Professor Harcourt.
He assigned a wide range of readings for his courses, which were, you know, courses at a law school on race, inequality, and civil rights and discrimination issues, including Frederick Douglass and other authors, which demonstrated this desire to place even narrow legal issues within a much larger literary, intellectual, political context.
Douglass Baird again.
He's not literate in that way because he thought it would be to his political advantage. I think he's literate in that way because this is stuff that really grabs him intellectually. He didn't spend a lot of time with his colleagues, but he spent a lot of time with students, and in the classroom is where I think he found a large part of his political voice. Again, you have a man who spent 12 years of his life carefully thinking through, reading, and talking about the American legal tradition with a group of incredibly talented individuals, and that's a significant part of his education.
On more than one occasion, Chicago Law School offered Obama a permanent lifetime position, which many academics would give their right arm for, and each time he turned it down, preferring to pursue politics. But when he failed in 1999 in an attempt to rise from state senator to congressman, law professor Jeff Stone thought the university was in with a chance.
Many of us, myself included, thought his political career was over. But shortly thereafter, he announced that he was a candidate for the Democratic Senate nomination. And this was at a point in time when it seemed most unlikely. The Republican incumbent seemed as if he would run for re-election and that he was a very strong candidate. And in any event, there were already four or five or six candidates for the Democratic nomination who were much better well-known statewide than Barack. And then one evening, I was at a large fundraiser for the Clinton Foundation, and I caught a glimpse of Barack wandering around the room, working the crowd. And he was doing what politicians do. He was moving from person to person and shaking hands and holding their elbows and looking deeply into their eyes. And I watched him for a minute or two, and I thought, this is pathetic. Several minutes later, I wound up with Barack literally at the shrimp bowl. So I said, Barack, I've been watching you wander around the room and work the crowd, and I don't know why you're doing this. I said, why don't you just pack it in and become a full-time academic? You'd really be good, and I think you'd really like it, and it's a great career. And he looked at me, and he said, thanks, Jeff. I appreciate that. But the truth is, I really feel I have a responsibility, and I really think I have an opportunity, and I have to pursue it. And I remember thinking as he walked away, what a waste.
After being dubbed an educated fool by his political opponents, Obama had realized that he had to play down his intellectual image. He's a very apt student of his own mistakes, according to former congressman and Chicago law professor Abner Mikva, who you could think of as his political father, in part because, like him, he combined academic law with politics. Obama needed to change his style, says Mikva.
The Socratic method and the thoughtfulness do not go across with large audiences. When you talk that way, when you're trying to rev up the troops and get them excited enough to go out in cold wintry days and ring doorbells and give more money than they expected to support you, that won't cut it. And he had to learn that the Socratic method, the dialogue kind of approach that he likes to take with intellectual questions, just won't work in elected politics, and he's done that.
By all accounts, Obama established a strict firewall between his political and his academic careers. Nevertheless, many students and esteemed faculty members from Harvard and Chicago campaigned for him. In the last election, you might say, the academy came canvassing. That's one way the 12 years he spent teaching paid off. Everyone I met saw themselves mirrored in the president-elect. He's black, he's not black. He's a Christian who understands Jewish traditions. He's an activist, he's a scholar. And so, he's supported by people of many identities. Lawyers see him as the consummate lawyer, community organizers as the committed activist, law and economics types see their impact on him, world travelers recognize him as a fellow cosmopolitan. The enthusiasm for him among academics is, I think, a kind of identity politics, too. We support him because he's one of us. Obama isn't into identity politics, but one identity which fits him, perhaps, is the professorial one. And in many ways, he's formal and reserved and very serious, and, some I spoke to said, rather cagey. Perhaps the University of Chicago tempered him. Everyone agrees it deepened his understanding of the Constitution. It left him with respect for the fabric of American law, which he clearly thinks is one instrument for changing society. And the Chicago Law School shows up in the way he uses the law and economics vocabulary, transaction costs, efficiency, and above all, the power of markets. In my attempt to understand him through all the theories and academic talk, nothing seems to capture the way he thinks quite as well as this odd story from Michael Kruglick, the community organizer, this one which is almost a parable.
I can remember one time when he and I were at a community meeting, and we were debriefing afterwards in a coffee shop. And then we came out to the parking lot late at night, and there was a panhandler who approached Obama and asked him for a dollar. Now, I don't know about you, but most of the time when that happens to me, I might give him a dollar or I might just keep walking. But Obama stopped him. He was a young fellow, probably about Barack's age. And he said, "Now, young man," he said, "you're better than that. And it really hurts me to see you bringing shame on yourself and on our community." He says, "I want you to think about that and figure out what to do about it." And then he walked on, didn't give the young man a dollar. So I asked him, why did you do that? He said, "Well, I could be that young man."
He comes across as almost a Victorian moralist there, urging uplift on the poor. But perhaps he has earned the right to that. He wasn't born into an American elite, but got there by working very, very hard. His primary motivation for entering politics was to improve life for the worst off. But his way of showing respect for poor communities is not to pour resources into them, but to help them to help themselves. He believes in self-improvement and discipline. Universities helped him to get to his goal, but his intellectual and personal gifts and his self-confidence arrived with him. He seems to feast on ideas and relish debate. He enjoyed being a professor. But that was only part of his life, and it was never part of his ultimate plan. Black law professor David Wilkins says Barack Obama always knew where he was really going.
This is a person who at age, at the time I knew him, he was probably 25, 26, you know, who had a remarkable sense of himself and what he wanted to do. And of course, he's grown tremendously through the experiences that he's had. But the core of who he is remarkably stable and consistent. And I think that is one of the great assets that he brings to these challenging times.
Obama, Professor President, was presented by Kwame Anthony Appiah and produced by Judith Kampfner. It was a Corporation for Independent Media production for BBC Radio 4. Well, last week, Kevin Peterson shocked the cricket world with his sudden departure as team captain. Next this evening, Profile will discover more about him.
My life, it was a stable life, but it came to a grinding halt.
1979. Iran has seen a second day of huge demonstrations against the rule of the Shah. It's estimated that once again a million people took to the streets of Tehran.
BBC Radio 4 hears from the exiles, forced to leave home and family in Iran.
For many people, life became very difficult. People started escaping.